Here begins the second part of my conversation with Edward Kieswetter, Commissioner of the South African Revenue Service and recently elected chairperson of the World Customs Organization. The first part of this conversation aired on the Pencast last week. Well, I can see how you're starting from day one with your letter to all employees. You would be able to set the tone and the terms of engagement of your mission there. But how do you reach the people outside of customs? I mean, a lot of customs officials have told me, I don't think society appreciates our job as much as they should. They don't fully understand. They resent our interventions. How do you communicate that to the larger South African public in such a way that their trust in you and their desire to comply increase?
Two things. The one has nothing to do with me, and the other one has everything to do with me. The part that has nothing to do with me is post-state capture, South Africa was just in such a bad way that they were looking for heroes. They were looking for reasons for hope. They were looking to gain some confidence in the system again. And I kind of effortlessly filled a need, a dying need, because I came in with a good reputation, both as a public servant, but also as a successful CEO. I had personal and institutional, I had personal and professional credibility. So my appointment was welcomed. You know, one of the journalists says, wow, it is unusual that when a taxman is announced, there is such a jubilation, there's such an outcry of. So I benefited from being in a bad neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eye is king kind of thing. The part that I assumed personally is, firstly, I write my own speeches, my own media statements. I ask my staff for input, data points. But in the end, I sit down and I craft a message that is authentic. So when I appear on television or on radio, people get that there's an authenticity about it. There's a trustworthy, there's a believability about this. I'm having this conversation with you completely unprepared.
Yeah.
I didn't script what I was going to say, right? No. And that's how I communicate, with simplicity, with clarity. I tell stories.
Mm.
And I do it often. So I don't have a spokesperson. I consciously decided that I'm going to be the face. I'm going to be the talking head. I'm going to get on stage. I put myself on Twitter. I was always on Twitter. So I manage my own Twitter. I don't have a team behind me following my tweets. If taxpayers come on there and insult me, I absorb it. I respond to that. If it's help that I need, I reach out, I help. So that part, I have worked very hard. It's unusual, Tom, for a taxman to walk through a shopping mall and for people to come up and say, can I have a selfie with you?
That's terrific. That must be a great.
Or to go in and people come up to you and say, we just want to say thank you for the work you do for our country. We really appreciate that. And people coming up and saying, you give us hope.
You know? Wow, that's powerful.
The president wrote me a personal note after our last results, and he said, thank you, Commissioner, for what you do. You have demonstrated to us what is possible.
Wow.
You know, so there's so much affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unusual when I go to the OECD and other forums. My counterparts are people in most countries don't even know the name of the revenue head, right, or the tax head. In South Africa, you know, you're kind of a public figure, which is unusual.
Well, you're a public figure. I don't imagine your predecessors were in any particular way. I mean, it sounds like you've made a name for yourself because of the role that you've stepped into and the role you've created actively.
Pravin Gordhan, who later became finance minister, he had some of that, not as much as commissioner, but he was definitely a key figure and a trusted figure. He's kind of, his star has waned because he stayed too long, my opinion. Mm-hmm. Going from being commissioner to being a minister. And it's, I'm sad for him because he deserved better. The my predecessor was known by many people, more his name than his face, because of his connection to corruption.
Right.
And so Commissioner Kizwetha now is the face of SARS. It's the trusted face. It's the face that is leading the recovery of SARS and therefore the huge impact on our fiscal integrity, because the more effectively and efficiently we do our work, we take the burden off on the politicians to just indiscriminately raise taxes or to borrow more money than what is necessary. So a well-functioning revenue authority has an inordinately important impact on the overall fiscal integrity of the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We talked about this a bit when we met at the World Customs Organization conference in Hanoi. Embracing the Digital Age was the name of the conference. Leveraging technology, fostering innovation, nurturing the next generation of customs professionals. Well, first, let's back up a second. It sounds like you have a full-time job already in South Africa. How did you get involved in, and what are the advantages to the benefits of becoming the chairperson of the World Customs Organization, which is another major job, another major responsibility?
You know, there's a word that says, if you want a job done, give it to a busy man. And it does help. I don't believe in work balance, Tom. Mm-hmm. Because work balance suggests that there is your life and there's your work, and somehow you have to balance these two things. I believe that work is an expression of your life. And in the same way that being a father is an expression of your life, and being a partner is an expression of your life, and being a family member, a brother, being a professional is another expression of your life. Mm-hmm. And if these different expressions of your life are congruent and they reflect who you are rather than what you do, it feeds you, it nurtures you, it strengthens who you are. So I find my involvement in the things that I do less stressful. And there's two kinds of stress. There's good stress. I have a lot of good stress. But I don't have unhealthy stress that keeps me awake at night, because none of the manifestations of my life are in conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. They all speak to my purpose of life, which is I'm here to be a blessing. I'm here to be a servant. And whether I'm being kind to my brother, taking care of my aging mother, or doing something for a granny whom I will never see, it feeds off the same sense of stewardship, of serving. And so when I then became involved in the Customs Council, obviously, there's a strong technical component. Because we talk about laws and policies and capacity building, and building technology support and data integrity. And so these are technical issues. And I think what I became personally known for at the WCO is I was able to elevate the conversation always to a strategic level. You know, I would often start an intervention by saying, let's just zoom out for a minute and reflect on why we are doing this. Mm-hmm. Or there's two presentations on data and technology. And I would say, why do we have two work streams on a subject matter which is converging? It's the same thing. And that's because people are transactional, right? If there's a presentation on risk, as if risk is another work stream, I would be the one almost always will say that risk is not another thing that we do. Risk is embedded in everything that we do. it's one of the lenses through which we look at our business, or whether it's the green economy. And so I've become known for a number of things. Firstly, being probably the philosopher in the room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you know, the one who zooms out and collects and connects various dots and form a composite, comprehensive picture, and a storyteller. So when the position for Secretary General came up, I was approached by a few countries to say, please put your name in the hat. We think you'll make an excellent SG. And I said, no, I'm going to retire next year. I've served my time. I don't want to be the CEO of anything anymore. So thank you for your vote of confidence, but no thanks.
Famous last words, yeah.
But that was for the SG role, which is a full-time employee. Then we were in Madagascar for a regional customs meeting, WCO customs meeting, and chatting to Kunio, the outgoing SG, realized that for the first time in almost in 15 years, we're going to have the changing of the guard of one SG to another. The incoming SG had spent his life in customs, but never in global customs. And this was going to be a big, big step up and role for him. And I think he's eminently qualified for that. That's Ian Saunders. Mm-hmm. But we were also changing chair because the chair had come to the end of his term. And it was in that conversation over a glass of red wine when I kind of had this bright idea, shouldn't I put my name in the hat? And of course, but I'm so naive that I arrived at the June Policy Commission and Council meeting, and I had not lobbied, because lobbying is an important thing here, because, you know, you're looking for votes. It's an election process, duh. you don't get interviewed for the job. And I'm not political, so I had not done any campaigning. I was asked by, so the EU had already chosen a candidate. So I was told, and Latin America had chosen a candidate. So I was told, but there are already two names. What do you want to put your name in the hat for? You know, it's a slam dunk. And I said, okay. And I was particularly told that, you know, the EU region is concerned because they think South Africa is aligned to Russia. And I said, you know, if they want to judge me for that, then they deserve to get who they do. I would hope that they would judge me for the contribution I can make and not from the country I come from. And my office very quickly prepared a small little pamphlet to compete against some of the glossy pamphlets and gifts and stuff that people hand out. And then you get to make a 7-minute or 8-minute speech. Mine lasted for 5 minutes. And the EU, you know, many of the EU, I was told the EU is uncomfortable. So I thought, okay, yes, I'm not going to get the EU, and you have to get some of the EU votes. I mean, some of the EU countries just came to me afterwards, beforehand, and said, we're going to vote for you. We think you'll make a great chair. And what I think had happened in the time, 4 years that I've been there, is I was able to earn the respect as an independent but clear strategic thinker and someone who can offer leadership. It's a huge privilege to be elected, because the election is really a vote of confidence. So that's how I ended up in trouble.
And what were your points for the future in your 5-minute speech, where probably other people went 12, 15 minutes? What were the key things you stressed?
So, well, first of all, an international forum like that by its very nature, can be politicized.
Mm-hmm.
And politics divide, right? And we know global politics is fractured, you know, and people take positions. They take sides, right? I have never taken a side. I always take a principle, and I guide a principle. And if the principle is that I'm against conflict, okay, then that's my position, regardless of who is considered to be the perpetrator, or whether or not they have a just cause. I think killing innocent people is just wrong. And nothing can justify killing children or innocent people. Nothing can. So my commitment was very clear. I made five commitments. I said, firstly, I commit to work with members to listen actively and ensure that the WCO strategic intent finds practical expression through, firstly, an effective and well-managed secretariat, a transformational modernization plan, an appropriate set of priorities, and a clear sense of what winning means. And I set that out because I thought that in many ways we are inefficient, we go around and around, one policy conference to another, and we don't make progress. And there's an inverse proportion or correlation between the more things you do on a fixed capacity, the less you achieve, right? You don't achieve more by adding more things on. And the hardest part of strategy is to choose what not to do.
Ah.
You can't just add. So that was my first. My second commitment was I'm going to advocate for greater inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like these clubs. I don't like these little constituencies, and greater inclusivity, but also with a strong focus on women and persons of disability. My third commitment was, I believe in partnerships, in relationships. And so I will focus on building resilient and effective partnerships with all stakeholders.
Hmm.
My fourth commitment was that I would strive towards enhancing the profile and the important role of customs in society, and ensuring that people understand that customs stands in the service by ensuring the well-being of society. And my fifth was to provide strategic leadership in support of these commitments.
Mm.
And I ended by saying, the role of WC chair presents me with an inordinate privilege to serve the customs family, whilst at the same time giving me an opportunity to fulfill my true purpose as a steward.
Wow, that's powerful. That's powerful. And the fact that you know every one of your points from many months after you delivered that speech speaks to your commitment to those points. You mentioned as your first priority a transformational modernization plan. How do you carry through at the WCO level or at the South African level a transformational modernization plan? What are the key steps to making that happen?
So the first question you must understand is, what are you transforming? Why are you transforming? Which is, what are you transforming for? And then the second question is, what are you transforming to?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've been in a big supermarket, Tom, where you're looking for directions, right? And when you see this big map, you don't start by looking for the shop where you're going to. You start by looking for that arrow that says you are here.
Right. True. Yeah.
Because if you don't know where you are, no plan will get you to where you need to be. And so I think a clear assessment of where we are in relation to serving our mandate is very important. So that's the first issue. Otherwise, you become transactional. If you don't, Einstein once said, if you give me an hour to solve a problem, I will spend 55 minutes to make sure I truly understand the problem. And so if I share with you, and I'm happy to do so on another plan, I shared with you the results of our revenue, our staff engagement. But if I share with you the transformation plan, you'll get what I'm saying now. Start with an absolute clear sense of where you are and an unambiguous clarity with where you want to go. Because those are the two points, right? And I find that most people in transformational plans don't have a clear sense of either of those two points, either where they are or what problem they're trying to address. So my focus will be to help the WCO to understand what we are trying to fix and why we are trying to fix that. The plan then follows that. Secondly, you then ask the question, what organizational arrangement will achieve that? Because structure must be informed by purpose and strategy. And then thirdly is, how do you equip a new organizational arrangement with competent leaders, which speaks to the appointment or election process? The engagement, the other thing that's problematic for us is our decision-making cycle is long because we meet every 6 months, and in between there's consultation, but they're not always meaning of the consultation. And when you then come to a meeting, there's diverse views. So the important role of a chair is to play a unifying role, to bring diverse views to converge. And I find that the best way to do that is to elevate a conversation at the level of the technical nuts and bolts and elevate it to the level of common purpose. And I find that almost always you get agreement on common purpose. And when you anchor that, and as a commission, we agree to why we need to transform and what the transformation is for, you then must let the secretariat empower them to implement that. And we can run the risk of them wanting to do the design and micromanage that. And so it's that clarity of what's the role of the secretariat, what's the role of the commission is effectively the board of the council, of the secretariat. So it's an exciting journey, but it has to understand what's the future of customs in the world, what are the current challenges of customs, but also what are the enabling resources we have, like data, artificial intelligence, technology, a future role for customs officials. So it's complex, but if you can tell it as a simple story, it's easier for people to believe it and to follow it, and more importantly, to see their role in it.
And a number, to come to your fourth point in your speech of 5 minutes, and I wish I had a recording of that. I would like to actually look that up. But it's striving to enhance the profile and the importance of the role of customs in society. A number of people have said, as I mentioned, that they don't feel customs is appreciated sufficiently by their societies. And other people have said, we need to move customs away from the borders, from the physical borders, out into society, not only to do our job better, but also to stress to the citizen on the street how important our role is. Do you agree with that assessment?
So customs have two roles that are often appear to be in conflict with each other. The first is to facilitate legitimate trade, which is a service, direct service to traders, to importers, to businesses, to travelers. Because the smoother that can go, the more you lower the cost of doing business and you facilitate and accelerate more efficiently the movement of goods and services from the point of source to the point of consumption. And all of that has a multiplier effect on the economy. But not all traders are honest, not all travelers are above board. So you balance that facilitation and service role with the enforcement role, where if there's a customs duty that's payable, the declarations must have integrity, there must be no risks of underdeclaration, of mispricing, but also of the importation of harmful goods to society. Harmful goods to society has downstream consequences of health and of social, the erosion of social fiber, the economic integrity. So customs has to have that. Now, when people say customs has to be less visible at the border, it means that a lot of the risk work must happen behind the scenes. And that's where data, artificial intelligence, and technology platforms becomes powerful. And then you don't need to be there to physically stop a traveler or a good because you've done the risk profile. I know ahead of time that Tom Miller is a honest traveler or an authorized economic operator. I will give you a green lane experience. I may do every 5 years a compliance assurance intervention with you, but not because I think you're a risk. It's more to give my stakeholders the assurance that we are okay with it, that nothing has happened to Tom's compliance profile in the last 5 years. So increasingly, the reason why in a physical world, physical presence is important is that show of force, that show of authority. Mm-hmm. But our compliance theory is that most people are actually honest and don't need to be policed. They just want to be facilitated. So why you can design a system either around your theory that most people are honest, which means you need more visible enforcement, or the theory that most people are actually honest, and then you have more of a facilitation and service orientation. Finding that balance is what we have to do. If we get it right, you don't need customs at the border posts to be physically present, and yet they'll be there if a risk appears. They'll know about it. They'll know that, you know, Edward Keyes would have boarded in Sao Paulo. This is his passenger name record. He's a frequent traveler there. Maybe he's a drug dealer. You'll know that before he even leaves Sao Paulo, by the time he lands in Johannesburg, there'll be someone to meet and greet you. The 300 other people on the plane won't even know. They'll just walk through. So that's what we mean, is more of the work must be strategic. It must be profiled in a way that isn't visible and intrusive. You don't have to stop every consignment on every traveler and physically search them. If your knowledge work, your AI work is good, you can let them seamlessly pass through ports of entry. And in any case, increasingly, physical borders, and I mean, today you can import a machine or a component, and I can send it to you via the internet, and you'll 3D print it in your home. It will never see a physical border. Right. So increasingly that's happening, which is as the world becomes more virtual and non-physical, our presence has to become more virtual and non-physical. And we can only do that with the power of data and technology and smarter people.
And people, effectively enough and fittingly enough, people end your statement and this conversation. And the teacher in you, the philosopher in you, is constantly focused on the quality of the people. Are they living the kinds of lives they want to live, and therefore are they doing what they need to be doing, both working for you and out in society. Ed Keyes-Witter, thank you for a really inspiring conversation, not only about customs, but also broader social issues, which rightly connect to customs in many, many ways. I can see that the South African Revenue Service and the WCR are both in very good hands. You've been listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation, a podcast that profiles leaders in customs and their views, ideas, and inspirations about the future of customs and postal innovation. Join us soon for the next Pencast and another insightful conversation with customs trendsetters and forward thinkers. Thank you.